everybody, and welcome to the Animation Podcast, a weekly podcast about all things animation brought to you by Filmbook. My name is Matt Brunet, but some of you may know me as Animat from my YouTube channel, Electric Dragon 505, home of web series that are all about animation, including Animation Lookback and Animat Reviews. If this is your first time here in the Animation Podcast, well, the title will explain everything for you. It is a podcast in which I shall talk about animation. No, I shall not talk about pottery. That belongs in the Pottery Podcast. Specifically, the latest news that happened this week. So on today's episode, we shall be looking at a brand new record that has been broken this year, with Zootopia being the fourth animated feature to ever surpass $1 billion at the box office. Then we will look into Russell Hicks, who has stepped down as president of Nickelodeon. Then we will be talking about The Killing Joke, and apparently you can see it in theaters. Then we will talk about a very controversial issue regarding women directing an animated feature, especially one for Studio Ghibli. And finally, we will end things off with Matt's Pick of the Week. If you want to check out more episodes of the Animation Podcast, then head on down to Filmbook, that is film-book.com, by searching the Animation Podcast. You can also email us at podcast@filmbook.com with the Animation Podcast in the subject line. Okay, so for our first story, this is honestly something that I was questioning if that was actually going to happen. But you know what? The more that I think about it, the more I realize, like, I think back of the days that I just look at the trailers and I think about the upcoming films that Disney would release. And honestly, I doubted this film. I didn't honestly think much of it. Like, this is really the true story of an this is the story of the animated film that could. And this is Zootopia. We're getting back into it once again. Now, if you recall last week, I actually discussed about how Zootopia actually became the number two biggest original film of all time, right under Avatar. And you know what? Like, I also kind of reflected back on the days of how, when you think back, how, I'm trying to remember, like, how, oh yeah, how, you know, original films or even original animated films are a very rare breed, and there are only a handful that still exist that only exist at least nowadays. But when it comes to Zootopia, thankfully we got one of them, and it's a very well-crafted, like, no one would ever expect it would become one of Disney's best films that they have ever done, and now they are getting the treatment that it fully deserves. At the end of last week's weekend box office, just 2 days before it was released on Blu-ray, which I actually got on the day of, by the way, Zootopia has officially passed $1 billion at the box office. Now, apparently this marks, with that said, it has apparently broken so many records during the process. It became the 26th feature film to ever surpass $1 billion at the box office. It became Disney's 11th feature film to surpass $1 billion. That is if you include the movies like the Star Wars, and you also include the Marvel movies. Like, those count as well. This also, like I previously stated, the fourth animated feature to ever surpass $1 billion at the box office, behind movies such as Toy Story 3, Frozen, and Minions. And this actually makes it Walt Disney Animation Studios the first ever animation studio in the world to have two movies that surpassed $1 billion at the box office, along with Frozen. And my God, just looking at this now, it's just honestly really phenomenal. Oh, wait, actually, there is one more thing I would like to add as well, that when it comes to the current box office as it is right now, Disney is pretty much dominating it this year, since three of the highest grossing movies this year so far include Captain America Civil War, Zootopia, which is at number two, and also Disney's The Jungle Book. Okay, so going back to what I said, this is honestly really amazing. And, you know, it really does warm my heart, and it really brings me such great joy to see animated movies like this getting the treatment that they deserve, like getting these records. I mean, like, okay, maybe kind of an exception would be Minions. I'm not saying it doesn't deserve it, but like in terms of the $4 billion animated films, like Minions is agreeably the weakest, but like with movies like Frozen and Toy Story 3, you know, getting up there in the records, like pretty much getting those, like surpassing $1 billion, you know, it really is great, because a fantastic film deserves to be seen by everyone and deserves such financial success. Like, this is why movies are like, this is why people go to the theaters to see movies. It's movies like this that really encourages us to get there. And honestly, I think, like, even out of all the film, like, even out of all the four films, like, Zootopia is probably the one that deserves it the most. Again, like, keep in mind, we're talking about an original movie here. Like, when you think of the other ones, like, you got Toy Story 3, which is a sequel, you got Minions, which is a spinoff, and you got Frozen, which is based on a classic fairy tale. In this case, Hans Christian Andersen's The Snow Queen. But then you got Zootopia, an original film that somehow brought in mass appeal to audiences and became this huge phenomenon. And like, just and like, and practically, you can argue that it came in just in time with the Blu-ray, which I will say, even the Blu-ray itself, like, it's absolutely worth getting. It is phenomenal, and it's honestly really surprising how they could just jam-pack all these bonus features in there. I was a bit surprised that they only did one Blu-ray instead of two, but still, it's really, really worth it. Not just owning it for the movie, but for the bonus features as well. But it's just fantastic to see this actually happen. However, there is one more thing I would like to add about this, and that is regarding the what's going to happen at this point. So, okay, so now we know that Zootopia has surpassed $1 billion, but at the end of its box office run, how much is it going to end off in total? And from the way that I see things, if I can be honest, like, we're pretty much at the end of its run. Like I previously stated, like, it surpassed $1 billion just 2 days before the Blu-ray was released. So we're pretty much close to the finish line. And from the way that I see it, it's going to be around Toy Story 3. It's going to be around those numbers. Now, keep in mind, Toy Story 3 has made around, I believe, $1.06 billion at the box office. While, like, I don't think it's going to get to the numbers of either Minions or Frozen, where Minions got, like, up to 1.15, and Frozen got, like, 1.27. So it's definitely for sure it won't beat Frozen numbers, and I don't think it's really going to get up to Minions numbers. But to Toy Story 3's numbers, that could be pretty possible. I mean, with the rate that it's going right now, and at the speed that it's going, like, it'll get, like, maybe a few million dollars more. Like, I, you know, honestly, it would not surprise me if it's going to be either under Toy Story 3 or over Toy Story 3. But if it's going to be over Toy Story 3, it's not going to be by a lot. Like, it could end up getting, like, $1.07 billion. Actually, let me double check on that. I just realized that I'm not 100% sure if what I said is actually correct about Toy Story 3. Is it $1.06 billion? I just need to, it's at least around those numbers. Let's see. Because even, even right now, it just surpassed $1 billion. Hold on. Like, if I go into Toy Story, am I correct? Oh yes, I am correct, actually. So it's $1 billion. Yeah, it's pretty much $1.063 billion. Yeah, at this rate, I'm not gonna say, yeah, okay, so I can pretty much confirm this, that I don't think it, like, I'm not gonna say it will, I'm not saying that at all, but I wouldn't be necessarily too surprised if it can. So, but with that, the rate that it's going, maybe it's going to stop somewhere. Like, I don't know if it's going to, like, maybe it can go a bit like 1.01 or 1.02, but that's pretty much going to be it, because, like, even at the box office speed that it's going, it's really going slow, and eventually it will end that we'll no longer have Zootopia. In fact, with the net, like, I'm thinking, like, since Finding Dory is going to be coming out very soon, I wouldn't be surprised if Finding Dory will be taking the place of Zootopia in theaters. So there could be that possibility as well. But still, I just want to say, so this is pretty much all to say, congratulations to the people at Disney and also directors Rich Moore and Brian Howard for creating such a phenomenal film and for pretty much getting this historical achievement. You guys absolutely do deserve it. Now, for our next story, this is something that I'm not necessarily, like, I know a lot about, but I'm pretty sure this is going to get a pretty good impact, at least in the studio. And what I am talking about is regarding in Nickelodeon that the president, Russell Hicks, immediately stepped down. Now, what happened apparently is that a spokesperson at Nickelodeon said that Russell Hicks, the president of Nickelodeon, has stepped down, has decided to step down from his position effective immediately. So, like, he just immediately there's no questions asked. He's pretty much out of there, like, immediately. But what's actually interesting to note is that the people who worked at Nickelodeon, they are rather they kind of knew this was expected already, considering that he, like, for a while, for months on end, he was pretty much absent. He was doing absolutely nothing. He wasn't really calling the shots. He was doing nothing. We don't know what happened. And apparently it said, and I'm taking this article from Cartoon Brew, by the way, that apparently Hicks' boss, Seema Zargami, president of Viacom Kids and Family Group, has taken an increasingly hands-on role in the network's decision-making. So he's pretty much, like, I think unofficially Seema is pretty much the new president of Nickelodeon. But apparently it is said on Deadline that he was pretty much out because, he's getting out of Nickelodeon because, he had returned from a 4-month medical leave. So that is on that part, it is a bit concerning because, like, he just stated that, okay, I'm out of the studio. I'm done. I'm out of here. Like, and had to go immediately. This does leave a bit of a concern to know, like, what happened. You know, like, is he okay? Does he have any medical attention? Like, honestly, the one thing that I absolutely do hope is that the next story that involves the name Ryan Hicks is not going to be that he's dead. That's the one thing I'm worried about. So we don't know what's pretty much specifically that's been going on, but it says, going more into it on the article, prior to assuming the top spot at Nick, Hicks has been a 14-year Nickelodeon veteran, including a chief creative officer for 6 of those years, where he oversaw all Nickelodeon creative, on-air promotion, consumer products, and brand and advertising division. When specifically, I wasn't specifically too sure, but apparently his legacy hasn't even appeared yet. Like, keep in mind that he's only been president for 4 years. Going back into the article, Hicks' legacy as president of Nick Animation won't be fully understood until a few years from now when all the projects under his watch have made it on the air. What has been going on recently, like, the rest was just listing all the shows that aired under his guise, including Sanjay and Craig, Breadwinners, Harvey Beaks, Pig Goat, Banana Cricket, The Loud House, and the yet-to-debut Pinky, Malinky, and Welcome to the Waynes. And you know, it's actually very interesting that we have yet to know what would be the shows under Russell Hicks, because when you do think about it, when you think about Nickelodeon right now, you know, they haven't made an impact as much as they used to, because, like, when you think of Nickelodeon shows, you think of the old ones, you think of the ones that were made in the 90s, and also from the early 2000s, like, you think about Ren and Stimpy, or Hey Arnold, or SpongeBob SquarePants, or Fairly Odd Parents, or Roscoe's Modern Life, or Jimmy Neutron Boy Genius. You think of those shows. You don't necessarily think about, you don't think about the shows right now. They haven't left a big, like, they haven't left any sort of impact, kind of like what Nickelodeon, or, no, not Nickelodeon, sorry about that. Like, they haven't left an impact as much as Cartoon Network or even Disney. Like, you would see everybody talking about shows like, they would talk about Steven Universe, they would talk about Adventure Time, they would talk about Gravity Falls. But the last time I've heard anything about a recent Nickelodeon show that really made an impact was The Legend of Korra, and that's it. Nothing really much afterwards. Like, okay, maybe SpongeBob, but, like, SpongeBob has been on for a long, long time, so that doesn't necessarily count. I don't know, maybe, like, with the stuff that Russell Hicks has done as president, maybe we'll see some new shows that can really, bring back the name of Nickelodeon back up. Like, even nowadays, like, they have to introduce the splat that, in order to bring back their, fame, they have to re-air their old shows, like, All That, and, Hey Arnold, and stuff like that. You know, like that's kind of a bit of a desperate call, but other than that, with Nickelodeon, it is going to be interesting to see if the Russell Hicks shows, they're really going to step up their game and they're going to bring back the glory of Nickelodeon so they can actually be going out there and compete against shows from Cartoon Network and Disney. Because keep in mind, they go through periods, and we see Nickelodeon is going in one of their lower periods. Like, they're a bit in their downtime, kind of like what Cartoon Network has been going through during the mid-2000s, in a way. Like, during the mid-2000s and the later 2000s. It wasn't until, like, in 2010, like, things start to really pick up, like, after Adventure Time and stuff like that. But, I don't know, maybe it's going to be soon Nickelodeon's time to shine, and who knows what they're going to bring up, but we'll just have to wait and see. And for now, let's just hope for the best for Russell Hicks, and hopefully what he has, if it really is a medical reason, then hopefully it's not going to be too serious. And yeah, it's going to be rather unfortunate if the next story is going to be about Russell Hicks dead. Okay, now I'm sorry for that little downer time. Now let's bring things up a bit, and let's put up some more exciting news of what's going to be going on. And what I'm going to be talking about is going to be regarding The Killing Joke, which is right now the most anticipated direct-to-home video animated Batman film that's ever been made, which I've never seen this much hype for a Batman movie ever since something like The Dark Knight or even The Dark Knight Rises. I believe, honestly, this could arguably be getting more hype than Batman versus Superman, really, for like several factors. But anyways, it looks like, now the funny thing is with this is that people are really excited for this movie to come out on DVD or Blu-ray or digital HD so that they can finally watch it at home. Oh, but oh no, there is a little bit more to it. If you really are that excited, you can get much more of an experience with it. So what seems to happen is that Warner Brothers is once again teaming up with Fathom Events. The last time that they have done so was later last year when they released the Iron Giant Signature Edition in theaters. Now they have teamed up once again for a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to release Batman The Killing Joke in theaters for one night only. Now the specifics is that they are going to release it on Monday, July 25th, and the running times are either at 7:30 or at 10. And apparently the runtime also adds in that it's 2 hours long. Now, with that said, not only, like, if you are going to go into the screening and watch The Killing Joke on the big screen, not only that, you're not just going to go and get that. Apparently, they also added some bonus stuff. Going into the website of fathomevents.com, it added Experience, a special introduction from Mark Hamill, plus a never-before-seen documentary of how Hamill was cast in the project and what the role means to him as an actor and a fan. The event will conclude with a special behind-the-scenes look at how the Joker's memorable yet disturbing song and dance number was recreated for the film. And honestly, the more news that I've been hearing about The Killing Joke, I'm going to be honest, the more that I'm buying into it and the more that I'm getting excited. Believe it or not, this week, I actually went and bought myself The Killing Joke, the Deluxe Edition comic. And like, I pretty much read through it from cover to cover just to solve my curiosity. And oh my god, like now, like I see what people are honestly really talking about this. This is honestly going to be crazy. And now, like, now that I've read the book and I know what's pretty much been going on, the only thing that's been wrapping my mind is that, okay, so now this is happening. How the fridge are they going to take the comic and put it into feature film? Now, of course, we know about the stuff that they are hyping this up to what could possibly be the best Batman movie, considering all the elements are going to be put in place. Like, this is the first ever Batman film that's going to be R-rated. This is also going to be the Batman film that's going to bring in a lot of the original people who are considered some of the best portrayals of their own character onto the film, especially from the animated series, including Kevin Conroy as Batman. We got Mark Hamill as the Joker. We got Tara Strong as Barbara Gordon, aka Batgirl. So we're bringing in those people onto that. And with all that said, people, and like, plus the fact that they are going to be very, very loyal to the comic and make sure they get that down to the point that even in the art style, like, even though it has a bit of that Bruce Timm inspired design on some of the characters, you can definitely tell on people like Batman and especially the Joker that they are going to stay true to the Brian Boland design with what they did there. Like, it's going to be crazy. Honestly, I'm as excited as you guys, and I do hope that they are going to announce that it'll be soon be available near my theaters. I would really like that. If I have the opportunity, then I would definitely take it. This is going to be a pretty crazy event, and hopefully we'll see how things go from there. But the one thing that I do hope is that with the bonus features that they're going to present with the Mark Hamill introduction and also the behind-the-scenes look, that these are also going to be bonus features they're going to put into the Blu-ray and into the stuff. Hopefully they will do that. With behind-the-scenes info like that, you cannot just put it as a once-in-a-lifetime event that you can only see it once and then it'll disappear. Like, at least either put it on YouTube or either put it on, or put it on the Blu-ray, actually. Like, that way, like, we'll all be satisfied for this. And, you know, like, this is going to be a fun event, so I like, if it does happen that I might even get my hands on it, we'll have to wait and see. But once again, I just want to remind you guys, if you guys want to go and check out The Killing Joke in theaters, it'll happen on Monday, July 15th at 7:30 or 10, and tickets will soon be available on June 17th. Okay, so for our next story, I'm just going to give you guys a bit of a warning right now that things are about to get very controversial. If you are easily offended, or if you are easily triggered, or any of that kind of stuff, it's probably best if you could go and skip this one right now. It's probably for the best, because what will end up happening is that you'll end up getting the emotions get the best of you, and you might even end up saying something in the comments section, or you might post it publicly, and you might say something that you'll end up regretting in the future of what you just said. So this is just a bit of a warning, and this dabs into a highly controversial issue, which is regarding women in the entertainment industry. Specifically, this one right now is female directors. Now, as you may know, it is a real hot topic, and no matter what the subject is, It is pretty much an all-out war, especially with the Ghostbusters reboot coming out, and people are making such a big fuss over the fact that the leads are pretty much female. And considering that with the trailer's release, it looks like it's not going to be a good movie, and people are just at an all-out war with each other. Like claims of misogyny and death threats are thrown at one another. It's pretty much turning into a big battle of idiots versus idiots. Now, with that said, let's go right into the story that I have right here. And this is apparently from an article, this is from Cartoon Brew that dug this up, but this is from an article of The Guardian when, the man writing the article for The Guardian, he had a chat with, director Hiromasa Yonebayashi and the new producer who took the job of Toshio Suzuki, Yoshiaki Nishimura. They went on and discussed about the Academy Award nominated When Marnie Was There. However, at one point, they discussed about, the interviewer raised the question regarding female directors. Like, would there be a time when if there's going to be a female director appearing at Studio Ghibli making a film for them. And Yoshiaki Nishimura's response, to go over here, I quote, "It depends on what kind of film it would be. Unlike live action, with animation you have to simplify the real world. Women tend to be more realistic and manage day-to-day lives very well. Men, on the other hand, tend to be more idealistic, and fantasy films need that idealistic approach. I don't think it's a coincidence men are picked." Now, with that quote, on Cartoon Brew, Amit Admiti pretty much picked this up, and he pretty much called Nishimura, he's sexist. It's kind of obvious that if you have been following Cartoon Brew and Amit Admiti, you could tell that the dude is a bit of an activist himself, and he would go and tackle on some social issues, so it wouldn't be that much of a surprise that he would look at this and call it sexist. And basically, that's what activists do when they see that quote, is that they only see the big picture, saying that what Yoshiaki Nishimura is saying is that women cannot be directors at Studio Ghibli. That's it. And pretty much, they felt like, pretty much at first glance, like, those people are just pissed when they see that. And it really is, apparently it's getting a lot of attention, this article. In fact, it even states that 85 people commented on the, or like 85 comments have been put in this article, a lot more than what Cartoon Brew would normally have. And it's honestly kind of ridiculous how like people are just immediately jumping in and pretty much trying to prove the facts of how ironic it is that the most female friendly studio, that one of its producers would say something as sexist as this. Because keep in mind that what Studio Ghibli is mostly well known is that the grand majority of their films would star a female lead. It's very rare that it would actually star a male, and even at that, it would star a male and a female, rather it be like in Castle in the Sky or Grave of the Fireflies. And even the only one that I can really think of, the only ones really that I could think of for now that stars a male lead would be Princess Mononoke and also The Wind Rises. There may be a few others, but they kind of slip my mind for now. No, those could arguably be the only two for now. And the rest actually star females. And what's actually crazy enough is that a lot of these movies, rather they be When Marnie Was There, The Secret World of Arrietty, Howl's Moving Castle, Kiki's Delivery Service, they're based on novels that are written by women. So, like, with that logic, women can do fantasy, and women can direct a Studio Ghibli film. So, immediately, people are just jumping in And, like, they're just pointing the finger at Yoshiaki Nishimura, calling him sexist. Okay. Now, that is at first glance. Now, when I first saw this, I thought, like, when I first saw this, I did react to myself, like, oh my god, dude, you're, like, I was thinking that Yoshiaki Nishimura was doing pretty much seppuku. Consider, like, plus the fact that when you think about, for those who have seen the documentary The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness, you would know that Hayao Miyazaki himself is a feminist, and even built the Studio Ghibli, you know, he built the facility of Studio Ghibli to make it more female-friendly, like it's more accustomed to females than it is to males. However, and this is a big however, now that's only at first glance. Now, this is a real, now the thing is, this is a real serious issue. So let's try to sink in and think about, like, what's going on with this entire studio, because this is only at first glance. Okay, now, number one, the most important thing that, well, not the most important thing, but one thing that I would like to point out is that, keep in mind, we're talking about a Japanese man, and as you probably may know, Japan, in terms of its culture, is far more different than how it is in any other place in the world, whether it be in Europe or in North America and stuff like that. And just saying that when it comes to Japan, they are the, like, they are not as easily offended as North Americans, especially nowadays with our internet culture. Like, anything we would say, even just a small opinion on a movie, like, people would just get in and they would flip their lid and they would be enraged. Like, never mind the fact that if you would say something that could questionably be racist or sexist, like, someone will jump, like, even if you make a small joke, like, people will jump at you and, like, they will call you a horrible human being just for that small insinuation or that small joke, rather it be, like, freaking intentional or not. Case in point, look at what's going on, well, like, just for a freaking Ghostbusters reboot. Like, do you think people should react this way, like, just for a Ghostbusters reboot? Like, really? Like, it's a bit ridiculous. And, I mean, with Japan, like, in their culture, they're not as easily offended. Like, you can easily get away a bit with something like blackface. And although the questions will be asked, that, like, you know, they can easily get away with it as much, like, they could get away with it easier than they would in North America. Like, in the US, like, they have to really alter that thing so that everybody could be pleased. And another thing to add is that in the culture of Japan, men are more seen as a more prominent figure than females. So, like, men are pretty much seen as, like, you know, the one that's supposed to be in charge. So it shouldn't really be that surprising that Nishimura would believe that, like, it could be a bit questionable with how women work. Like, they wouldn't necessarily get into, like, a directing project more properly than a man would for an animated feature. Now, with that said and done, like, that's just the culture alone. However, if there is a homework I would like you guys to do, this is something that's very important. This is just something that is really, really fascinating, is that if you go on Cartoon Brew and you look into this article that it says, Studio Ghibli producer claims women are too realistic to direct their films, this also comes with a picture of Princess Mononoke. You go down in the comment section and read the comment made by Brian L., as a reply to RackAttack_Force. The dude pretty much just wrote he wrote an entire freaking essay in the comment section that's actually a bit of a defense to what Yoshiaki Nishimura just said. And my god, like the points that Brian brought up, like, these are phenomenal. Like, this really changed my perspective of things when I read this. It's so amazing. Basically, I'll try to sum it up, to sum it up as best as I can with this article, is that what Brian is saying is that he pretty much made this entire essay explaining how women are more dominant when it comes to emotions and how men are more dominant when it comes to imagery. So, he pretty much goes on, he goes on to go and say that, because women are more direct with emotions, that is why you see women dominating novels. Like, you see a lot more female novelists, you see a lot more female readers. Like, novels are made more for women. However, when it comes to men, they are more dominant because they're more direct with imagery. This is why you see a lot more men dominating comic books. And this is why you would see men not only dominate comic books, but also have the approach, like, you see a lot more readers that are men that, you know, it's guys who like to go and read about, you know, like, to have comics and, you know, have all those imageries put up. And then he would also bring up how in the animation industry, how, like, he brought up a good example here that when it comes to animation, he goes into television, since TV, like, American television is a lot more liberal when it comes to male and females in animation. He said, and I quote here, "Television under male creators saw Dexter's Lab, Samurai Jack, Dragon Ball Z, and Cowboy Bebop. Television under female creators saw Angela Anaconda, Pepper Ann, Stoked, Total Drama Island, Steven Universe, My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, and Star versus the Forces of Evil." And if I may add my car, some more into it, you could probably, like, with under male creators, you can think more of stuff like an anime like Attack on Titan or Death Note. Or with female directors, you could think of Holic, you know, Triple X Holic. Also, another really interesting one. He actually wrote down another quote. "Most female Pinterest users, 79% of its users, are, they talk about delicate topics, weddings, recipes, beauty, craft, romance, family life, dream vacation getaways. Most male Pinterest users are dynamic topics, sports cars, weapons, machines, military, sports, battle, shapely women." And, you know, he brought, so, with all that said, it's actually very fascinating. And another topic that, and another thing that he brought up, which is actually very, very true, is that you can't just hire a woman because she's a woman, okay? When it comes to, because the thing is, when it comes to animation, creativity conquers all. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. If you have a good creative idea, then you're pretty much good to go to make a project, whether it be an animated TV show or an animated feature or stuff like that. Now, if you're just going to hire a woman because she's a woman, that's not going to work out well. And that's probably one of the things why, you know, like, just activists in general, I feel like they might not be as intelligent as they seem to be because they always act before they think. Because what would you rather, like, because in a case like making an animated feature, would you like to have an animated film be very well made, you know, like, nicely crafted, highly praised, really well done, but it's actually made by a male? Or would you like an animated film that's made by a woman, but it ended up sucking? It's just, it doesn't look good. It's just, the animation doesn't look right. The script sucks. It's just nothing about the animated film works. And it just ends up not looking good. Like if a woman kind of directed Norman the North in a way. Like, would you rather have a really good animated film directed by a male, or would you have a really bad animated film directed by a female, just to say that, well, at least a woman directed it? No, it just doesn't work. Like, you gotta really think those things. And especially for something like Studio Ghibli, like, you can't just come in and be, and, like, just get a director just because. Like, you can't do that, because, like, when it comes to something like Studio Ghibli, it is near impossible to find someone that could get up to the ranks like people like Hayao Miyazaki and Isao Takahata. keep in mind, we're talking about two of the most acclaimed, some of the greatest Japanese directors in animation history. Do you think not just a woman, but a man would go up there and try to get up to the ranks as something like Spirited Away or Grave of the Fireflies? It's almost impossible. I mean, like, sure, there are a few exceptions of directors, like, not just Hiromasa Yonebayashi, and also, like, we got Gorō Miyazaki, and then you also got the directors of Whispers of the Heart and The Cat Returns. But even at that, like, even those movies, even though some of them are great, like, the one who is actually the closest to actually get, to actually really become the next, like, Hayao Miyazaki or Isao Takahata would actually be Hiromasa Yonebayashi. I mean, his works with R. Yeti and When Marnie Was There are just phenomenal. Technically, also the director of Whisper of the Heart as well, but it's really unfortunate that he passed away at such a young age and, like, only getting that one credential of being the director of Whisper of the Heart, and that's it. That's rather unfortunate. So you can't just bring in a woman to direct just because she's a woman. No, you got to do it. You got to get it right. And then, but also the biggest thing, but then going back into the argument regarding how women get a more emotional approach and men are more in an imagery approach, he also brought up some very good points as well regarding animation, how in terms of the movies that Studio Ghibli makes, let's go back into the quote made by Yoshiaki Nishimura, where women are said to be more realistic and men are more idealistic, which for fantasy films you need to be idealistic. Now, it is, like, I can see what he means. Now, because the thing is that with animation, it is a visual medium. And this is why, like, when it comes to males pretty much dominating the comic book industry because of the imagery that is required to do it, that is why you see a lot more male directors dominating the animation industry, because it's all about the imagery. It's all about the looks. With women, on the other hand, it's all about the emotion. It's all about the heart. In fact, what's actually a good example with all this, just imagine Holic is actually a really good example. Because when you think about it, like, when you think about something like Holic, this is actually made by Clamp, which is actually a group of female manga writers and creators. I just want to say this right now, Holic is an amazing anime. In terms of it visually, it's not the best looking anime per se. I mean, everything about it just looks weird. I mean, like, you see the characters, they look like their arms and legs are just so freaking long on top of having a tiny head. You know, it looks like you're in the world of Slender Man in a way. So visually, it's not the best, but in terms of the writing and the core of Holic, that's what really makes it strong. Technically, it's not the kind that really has emotions, but it really does. This is a really thought-provoking anime where it gets in, where, like, you pretty much learn about how, you know, basically, not really simple life lessons, but more complex life lessons, where, you know, the way, like, it really does they go into these small issues, but really, they're the kind that really makes you think. So it's more in the quality of the writing and the approach, and mostly the approach of characters like when you think about characters like Watanuki or Yuko. Like, you could see how Watanuki is more of an emotional basket case. Like, the dude is nothing but full of emotions. And even with Yuko, like, when she needs to be serious, like, she can be serious, but then again, like, they also build up her character by being more playful. So at least, like, with the emotions, they can make these characters believable and a lot more likable. That's why, not just the messages that that each episode brings up is very memorable, but also the fact that you get memorable character, the fact that you also get memorable and fleshed out characters like Yuko and Watanuki with all the emotions that are brought in, like they make some really good characters. And plus the fact that when it comes to the fantasy, there really isn't, like, when you do think about it, there really isn't much fantasy. Like, it is technically there, but there really isn't much of it. And when there is, like, episodes that do emphasize fantasy, they feel like they kind of, you know, they kind of stand, like, they're not, they don't really connect well to the other episodes. Like, they kind of, well, like, not necessarily stand out, but, like, they're a little too different. They feel like the tone suddenly changed a bit. And on top of that, but there's also the factor that, of course, now this is a very, very rare thing, but there have been women who solely directed animated features before. Now, most of the time, like, when you think about stuff like Frozen or Brave, Kung Fu Panda 3, unfortunately, they always had to be accompanied by a man. That's why with Frozen, it's not just Jennifer Lee, it's also with Chris Buck. But when it comes to two films that are so far the only ones that I know about that are directed only by a woman, you got the oldest living animated feature to date, The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, and then you also have the 2011 Kung Fu Panda 2, directed by Jennifer Yu. Now, it is true that they do, like, these are films that really do have fantasy. You know, these are films directed by women, and, you know, they do have a core element of fantasy, especially with the story, the fantastical storytelling of The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, or even, like, all the kung fu action that you got with Kung Fu Panda 2, since it is a kung fu movie, that you gotta put in some kung fu action, and the ways that they did it is even visually very creative. But on top of that, there are some elements that do make it strong because there is a woman. The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, even though it is the oldest, like, visually, it does have a unique approach considering it does go into a bit of, like, a bit of a stop-motion shadow puppetry in a way. But also, you got a bit of a romance into it as well. And even with Kung Fu Panda 2, you got another emotional aspect when you look into when you look into the origins of Po. Like, how did he become the panda that he is now? And, like, how did he ended up becoming the son of Mr. Ping? Like, where did these emotions get to, and how he is how pretty much this is all struggling him, you know, to find out really who he is. And, you know, that, like, and that works, you know, it really does work. So with all that said, is there anything more that I can go into this? So with that said, like, if we go back once again into the quote that Nishimura has said, like, maybe he didn't use the right words. Like, technically, instead of saying women intend to be more realistic, he would say, well, okay, maybe that does sound a bit sexist, saying that women tend to be more emotional. But what he's trying to say is that women approach movies in a more emotional way, and men approach it in a more visual way. And especially with the medium of animation, you got to do it with, you got to do it with visuals. It's all, like, it's mostly about the visuals and how to represent a story with the visuals. That's why it's mostly men doing it. So with that said, and plus the fact, I would like to add that nowhere that Nishimura said that he didn't say that a woman cannot direct a Studio Ghibli film. He did not say that at all. What he's pretty much saying as a whole is that technically, a woman can you can bring in a woman to direct at Studio Ghibli, but it's going to be questionable if her approach to a movie will capture the same feeling as all the other Studio Ghibli films, rather they be made by Yonebayashi, Miyazaki, or Takahata. Now, if I may put my input into it, the one thing I would like to say is that since we are going into a different age, like, we're entering a bit in a new era of Studio Ghibli, technically we are still in their hiatus, and the last movie that they have done is still When Marnie Was There. Honestly, I would like to see them give a shot, you know, give, if there is a woman, like, if there is a woman that is capable of making a movie, making a Studio Ghibli film, then bring her in. You know, like, it would be interesting. If they do want to go back into making feature films, they can't just have Hiromasa Yonebayashi. They need to have a few more people. So, I'm not saying that yes, they need to have a woman direct a feature film because they need a woman directing a feature film. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, honestly, that's just a dumb mindset that you're only, that's just acting before you think. What I'm saying is, if they're able to get a woman who can direct a Studio Ghibli film, who understands what makes a Studio Ghibli film work, then they can by all means, bring her in. Like, it'll be interesting even. Maybe she's not going to bring in the exact same thing as, like, a Miyazaki film, but, you know, maybe she'll bring in something more unique. You know, there'll be something interesting about it. There'll be something that stands out from the other Studio Ghibli films. A bit like how, Arrietty and When Marnie Was There with Hiromasa Yonebayashi. And plus the fact that a woman, when it comes to emotions, a woman can easily come in, since, when it comes to Studio Ghibli films, it's not really about the action. It's not really about the extravagant visuals, even though that they have done a phenomenal work in it. It's more about the emotions of the characters. Like, never will you ever find characters that are so human, that are so realistic in that kind of sense. So a woman is a woman can easily come in and she can easily develop characters that are easily emotional. So yeah, overall, I want to say that, North Americans can easily go hard on Nishimura and calling him sexist or misogynist, because that is the hot trend of what you do, just call people sexist and misogynist because whatever. But, you know, honestly, I would like to see, if there is a woman who can direct a Studio Ghibli film, but we'll just have to wait and see. First, we need to wait until Studio Ghibli does come back into making feature films, if that'll ever happen first. But yeah, this is a really hot topic. But hopefully, I have shed some light in this situation. But that's pretty much the whole scenario on the table. So I'll leave it to you, and we'll see if a woman can, then she can. But it'll probably be, honestly, it'll be up to Studio Ghibli to see if one day we'll have a Studio Ghibli film directed by a woman who can make a Studio Ghibli film. And finally, we will end things off with Matt's pick of the week. Now for this one, oh boy, this is mostly a really weird one, mostly because of the fact that this exists. I mean, this is the kind that when you listen to the concept, you're just there like, what? Excuse me? This is a thing? Like, honestly, that's my reaction. I remember, the way that I discovered it was probably the last thing that I would ever expect. Like, you know, I was just minding my own business, you know, just checking out on Facebook, you know, just, you know, just procrastinating, looking at the stuff of what's going on in there. And then suddenly, I find a promotional event apparently near my quarters, this is going to be a thing, along with pictures that I'm just looking at it going, what the fridge? This is real? Like, I had to question myself several times before, several minutes later, I have to accept the fact that this is a real thing. That it really is a real thing. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Ice Age on Ice! Now, for those of you that don't know what it is, Ice Age on Ice is a live show, a live skating show, very similar to what you would get with Disney on Ice, with the 100 Years of Magic show and stuff like that. But instead of having Disney characters, you're getting Ice Age characters. You're getting Sid, Diego, Manny, and Scrat just dancing along. And for those of you wondering what it, okay, but what the show is about specifically, if you guys want to know, allow me to read it to you on the official Ice Age on Ice website. Oh my god. Honestly, guys, I think I'm still having a bit of a difficulty that this exists. But anyways, okay, so about Ice Age on Ice. Ice Age on Ice, based on the blockbuster multi-billion-dollar animated movie franchise, featuring Scrat, Sid, Manny, Diego, and the rest of the prehistoric pals as they bring an avalanche of adventure to the ice for the first time ever in North America. Scrat gets a wake-up... Okay, so... Alright, now the following is going to be about the plot, so listen up. Scrat gets a wake-up call of his life when he buries his prized acorn in a once-dormant volcano that rumbles back to life. With an eruption threatening our Sub-Zero hero's way of life, they must find the magical frostberry to stop a tidal wave of lava and save themselves from certain extinction. Join the entire herd for the coolest show on Earth. Ice Age on Ice brings laughter, adventure, and the thrill of spectacular skating to fans across the country. What? The fridge. And honestly, they actually included a trailer. And basically, from what I see in the trailer is that, yeah, like, this is for kids. Like, I'm just gonna, like, the first thing I'm gonna say this out now. It's for kids. It is just for them. Basically, what you would get, like, remember when you see the trailer of Ice Age Collision Course? You remember how juvenile it is? Yeah, you're basically gonna get the same thing with Ice Age on Ice. And if you look into the plot, you might notice that it doesn't look, it doesn't sound familiar. Like I'm sure you have never heard of this plot before. It's not necessarily based on one of the movies. What it is actually an original. This is actually an original story. However, based on the images that we got, they do actually feature a lot of characters, including Peaches. You get the girl squirrel from, you get basically, Scrat's love interest in a way. Basically, it looks like this is based on, a story that would be between the third and the fourth movie. And like I said before, Peaches is pretty much the biggest indicator because, like, you see Peaches as a baby and she's not yet a teenager. And, like, we haven't gotten any of the other characters. Like, we don't have Diego's love interest, you know, that girl tiger. Like, we don't have her. And plus the fact that the girl squirrel does come back. And, you know, if I look, like, looking into the costumes. Now, I put, like, but before saying that, like, I have seen on, I posted this on Twitter. And people are having the same reaction as me. Like, they're just there, oh my god, why does this exist? But there are a couple of people out there who actually did praise about the costumes because they actually look identical to their animated counterpart. Now, I will agree that, yeah, they, like, in terms of what they did with the costumes, it looks exactly like how they do in their animated films. Like Sid looks like Sid. And honestly, my favorites would be like the mammoths, like Manny. They look like what they're supposed to be. But there is one. But I do have an issue with the costumes. However, it's that they look. The thing is that they kind of have this uncanny valley. Like, you know that. Okay, like, let's take a look at the Disney mascots. Like, when you go into the parks and you see characters like Mickey or Minnie or even the recent ones like Olaf or Judy Hopps or Nick Wilde. Like, when you look at them, the design of the characters, they're not necessarily as complex as the ones in Ice Age, but at least, like, when you bring them to life, you know, it has a welcoming approach. It's not too complex that they have to put in so many details, but at least it's accurate enough that it looks like their animated counterparts. Like, you can definitely tell that is Olaf, or that is Woody, or that is Buzz, or that is Mickey. With here, however, they do it so, like, they actually look so much like their animated characters, it's honestly unsettling. Like, you're unsure if you want to meet Sid, Diego, and Manny in real life. And plus the fact that, technically, like, with the Disney shows nowadays, that technology has become a lot more sophisticated, and you see, like, characters like Minnie, Mickey, Goofy, and Donald, like, their mouths and eyes would actually move as they would talk. Like, you know, it actually brings more life to the characters. These ones do not. Like, you can tell that Sid has his, like, kind of has, like, this blank stare. Like, he's not, like, his mouth is not going to move, or his eyes is not going to move. But honestly, the creepiest looking characters, the ones that are really uncomfortable to look at, is actually Scrat and the Squirrel Girl. And the reason for that is because, the thing is that, okay, they got their heads look correct. It's just the bodies, well, it's fursuits. It's literally, you got Scrat's head in a with human anatomy with a giant bushy tail. That's literally it. And it's kind of uncomfortable to look. It's really uncomfortable. It's just weird. It's unsettling. And like I said before, looking into the trailer, it's like, oh my god. Like I said, it is absolutely juvenile. And, you know, the thing is that it looks like you're going to get a lot of Sid's shenanigans. And especially there's this one part that really did freak me out. I don't know if this is a fever dream or something, but, like, you see Sid, and there's, like, a group of all other sloths. And I don't know what that is. I don't know if they're doing, like, a little dance number, but, yeah, I don't know. Oh, and, oh my god, I just realized, like, this could be, like, maybe they could do this as a musical. I just realized, like, there could be a chance that they want to make this as a musical. That kind of freaks me out, honestly. It's like, oh god, they're going to turn a musical out of this, or maybe they're just going to do dance numbers. And that, like, honestly, that's another reason why I'm scared of that Sid number, is that, like, oh my god, like, do you remember in the fourth Ice Age movie, there was at one point, like, Sid was just doing stupid things. That's literally the scene. It's just Sid doing stupid things in front of gophers. Just doing, oh, wugga, 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 wugga. And you know it's actually very sad over the fact that I accurately described the lines very, very well. That's like, yeah, it sounds really stupid, but it's accurate. I'm so sad to say that. But yeah, but oh my god, imagine you're gonna get a lot of that just in a live show form, so, oh boy, oh good god. And you know the scariest thing is that, I had my mind off of Ice Age for a while, and then this brought up, and like, I had to try to wrap my head around it, and then I thought about the fifth movie coming out, Collision Course. Like, I thought to myself, okay, well, like, I guess we're always gonna get Ice Age stuff since next year is going to be Ice Age Collision Course. Wait a minute! That's not right! Collision Course is not coming out next year! It's coming out next month! We're never going to escape Ice Age! Why do you do this, Blue Sky? We gave you so much praise for Peanuts movie, and this is the thanks we get? Why? Why do you suffer us with Ice Age movies? This is why no one cares about you. This is why you are not up in the ranks with DreamWorks, Disney, Pixar, Illumination, Studio Ghibli. This is why no one cares about you, because you won't let Ice Age die, and now you're bringing it to life on ice? Why? Why in the fridge do we need this? Alright, but anyways, I don't know regarding the U.S., I don't know regarding American tour dates. So far, on the website that I'm on, it only lists just the Canadian ones. And apparently it's starting a bit more later, like a month after it's going to be released, after they release Collision Course. Starting, apparently, at least in Canada, it's going to be August 20th starting at August 20th in London, Ontario at the Budweiser Gardens, which the next one is going to be in my quarters at the Bell Center in Montreal from August 24th to August 22nd. That's how I discovered it. And it's going to go all the way down to December 2nd to December 4th at Halifax, Nova Scotia in the Scotiabank Center. And oh my god. Seriously, guys, I don't know how to deal with this. I just don't know how to deal in a world of Ice Age on ice with real life Ice Age characters. I just don't know how to deal with this. But in the meantime, that'll be all that I've got for this week. So thank you guys so much for listening to this episode of the Animation Podcast. You can find more of my work at film-book.com. Just search for Matthew Brunette or the Animation Podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at anima505. And if you have listened to this podcast on iTunes or any other podcast service, then do us a little favor and go and rate and review this episode. That would be very nice. But also, if you have listened to this podcast on YouTube, then hit that like button and leave us a little comment regarding your thoughts about the news this week. Tune in next week for the latest episode of the Animation Podcast and all things animation. Thank you guys so much for listening, and until next week, see you later, dudes!